I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
I'm Ken Nash.
And this is Building Bridges. Has COP27, the Global Climate Conference, concluding in Sharm el-Sheikh, provided anything? Or is it proven to be little more than a dog and pony show, a major greenwash of the responsibilities of the wealthy countries as climate activist Greta Thunberg, who boycotted it, projected it to be for those rich countries, responsibility for that sword of Damocles of climate degradation hanging dangerously over our heads? Where goeth COP27?
Let's put these questions to Basav Sen, director of the Climate Policy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, and Shayok, climate activist with Extinction Revolution. Shayok and Basav Sen, your takeaway on COP.
Thank you for having me on the show. This is Basav Sen. I should point out that technically, there's still about a week before we can pronounce final judgment on what's coming out of COP27 because the conference will continue. The major world leaders have made their speeches and left, but the real work of coming up with some kind of substantive agreement is still going on, being conducted by middle-level officials, you know, with full direction and control by their higher-ups. But it is fair to say that from what we've observed so far, the prospects of the wealthy countries actually taking responsibility for the harm they have done is close to minimal. However, there are some silver linings, which, you know, I can get to later. But primarily, one of the contentious issues at this year's COP27 and at last year's COP26 was so-called loss and damage, where, you know, when a country faces an extreme climate disaster and doesn't necessarily have the resources to pay for it, and with most countries in the global south, in Africa and Latin America and parts of Asia and the Pacific and the Caribbean, they really don't have the resources to pay for it, then who pays? And one of the core demands of the global south is that northern countries who are responsible for the damage because of their historical emissions should step up and set up a fund out of which Global South countries can get paid. And of course, the northern countries have dragged their feet. It was only very recently that John Kerry, the U.S. climate envoy, finally agreed in principle that there should be a loss and damage funding facility. But even there, the devil is always in the details because he did not specify whether it would be grant funding funded by the northern countries or not. Because the last thing we need is more loan funding. The last thing we need is to saddle the global south with still more unpayable debt. And that's, of course, doubly unfair if it's to pay for damage for which the lenders who are earning the interest are themselves responsible. Then another plan that has been floated by the European Union is called the Global Shield, which is almost like an insurance program that poor countries undergoing climate damage must pay into. But there again, you are asking countries who have zero responsibility and zero blame for these disasters to be the ones to pay for it, while the ones who caused the damage in the first place are, you know, getting away scot-free. So that's the state of the loss and damage negotiation, where evidently, I mean, it's too early to tell, but evidently some kind of funding facility maybe would be set up, but some of the proposals and possible proposals for this funding facility are profoundly unjust and do not address the core moral demand from the global south. So that's one example of, you know, of lack of progress in COP27.
And Shaik, I'd like you to weigh in on this too. And we are talking about COP27, which, if people wonder what that stands for and why it has the name COP, well, its actual name is not much better, Conference of the Parties, but that is the name and that is what we're talking about. And you are with a ferociously and wonderfully fierce activist climate group. Your thoughts on COP27 and some of the things that have been said by Basav Sen.
I'm Shaik. I'm with the Extinction Rebellion NYC. And honestly, I mean, COP27 is honestly not on our radar. I mean, this is not something we've spent any time thinking about or paying attention to, because we know it's an absolute waste of time. I mean, who's sponsoring COP27? Coca-Cola? I mean, are you serious? This is the world's largest plastic producer. It's behind a huge amount of industrial farming that causes obesity and disease. I mean, come on, this possibly cannot be serious. At this moment, what we are much more inspired by and what we really look up to is the activists in the UK, like Just Stop Oil. The amount of disruption that they have been able to carry out on a regular basis, and they've been able to get on mainstream TV programs on a regular basis. I mean, where they're being told, hey, why are you creating trouble in the UK? Why are you blocking highways here? Why didn't you go to COP27 and do it there? I mean, you can obviously tell, like, that's the distraction. They want activists to be there, to be, like, safely penned there. And then that's not what activists should be doing. So we regard it as a complete distraction and waste of time, and we are much more focused on organizing people here than, you know, focusing on some, like, a real waste of time for the very many legitimate reasons that Basav points.
Well, let's go back to Basav. I still want to kind of explore and tease out this issue. The United States was really just completely a naysayer on anything that had to do with looking at the disparity in terms of the actual cause and the wealthy nations that are wreaking havoc on the rest of the world, and any kind of compensation or any reparations for the loss of these people's livelihoods as a result of the industrialization process of the wealthy nations. Your sense and your thoughts on that. So was it any breakthrough, or was this just a completely sham corporatocracy and big government, as we started to say, dog and pony show, that left the poorest nations and the most vulnerable high and dry or inundated by water and drowned out?
Let me actually draw out two different points based on your question. One is, and this is of particular interest to listeners here in the United States, one is that the United States has always, since the start of the UNFCCC, the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, you know, since the start of these negotiations, has always been obstructionist number one. For instance, U.S. negotiators watered down the Kyoto Protocol, and after watering it down and insisting on including so-called market mechanisms in it, to allow polluters to trade pollution instead of cutting pollution, they walked away. And then, years later, when the Paris Accord was negotiated, one thing you will keep hearing in U.S. mainstream media coverage is that Obama and his Secretary of State, John Kerry, engineered the Paris Accord. And, you know, without them, there wouldn't be a Paris Accord. And it was supposedly one of Obama's big foreign policy success. Well, from the standpoint of the Global South in particular, Obama was the person who torpedoed the Paris Agreement. The U.S. sabotaged it and made sure that instead of a binding agreement with nations making binding cuts to their emissions based on their current emissions, their historical responsibility, and their wealth. How rich are they? How much is their per capita income, etc.? So that the burden of adjustment does not unfairly fall on poorer countries and ones with less resources. That's the kind of binding agreement we ultimately need to address the climate crisis. But instead, what we got was this joke of a Paris Accord with voluntary cuts. Countries can volunteer to cut their emissions as much as they feel like. Well, the laws of physics and chemistry don't care with what you volunteered. We have to cut our emissions on a binding schedule, and the richest countries have to step up and cut their emissions first. And the U.S. was the lead player in making sure that that did not happen. And then in, you know, subsequent, for instance, in last year's COP26, the U.S. definitely played a role in watering down the language on fossil fuels to the point of making it meaningless. For one thing, by focusing the statement solely on coal, which is very convenient for the U.S. because it's the world's largest producer of oil and gas and a major exporter, and is showing zero inclination to cut its oil and gas production. So yes, the U.S. is obstructionist number one, and there is no sign that that's going to change in COP27, which means it's incumbent upon social movements, upon organizations like Shayok's organization and my organization and other movement organizations we work closely with, to compel the U.S. government to do something it's clearly not willing to do. So that's one piece, which is the role of the United States. Now, in terms of whether this whole thing is a symbolic dog and pony show or not, I'm going to come to what I said were the silver linings. Countries in the global south are fed up with the foot dragging by wealthy countries and are becoming more and more strident in their demands. This year, there's very clearly a demand for climate reparations to the global south. And the group of 77 countries, which is a group of lower income countries who negotiate together, this year, the chair of the G77, as it's called, happens to be Pakistan, which went through one of the most severe climate disasters that any country has ever faced in its history, where at the height of the flooding a couple of months ago, one-third of the country was underwater. So now Pakistan and other countries are openly demanding climate reparations from the global north. And there is a parallel demand for cancellation of all the so-called external debts owed by the Global South countries to the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, regional development banks, and private banks, because the debt burden is another drain on the resources of these countries that gets in the way of their being able to pay for climate mitigation and adaptation and loss and damage. And it's yet another case of, you know, they are paying interest for debt to the very same wealthy countries and the institutions they control and banks based in those countries who, you know, caused the problem in the first place through their emissions. So there's increasingly strident demands from countries in the global south. And likewise, civil society movements, social movements from the global south, as well as from here in the United States and other wealthy northern countries, have formed some real bonds of solidarity and share some common demands, both around the global north paying the global south for loss and damage and mitigation and adaptation as a form of reparations for the climate damage that they have done. but also for northern countries to cut their own pollution and to cut their own fossil fuel production, which disproportionately harms frontline communities, you know, black and indigenous and low-wealth communities.
Shayak, I want you to comment on this in terms of the protests that are happening, that your organization is projecting, and what's being done in terms of on the streets.
And I think the question is also, Shayak, your thoughts on what Basav Sen has been saying and the agenda, ultimately, of Extinction Rebellion.
Yeah, so, I mean, Basho pointed out a few items of what he calls silver lining, but unfortunately, I am not that optimistic. I mean, the global north essentially wants to retain its lifestyle as it stands today. And the story that's sold by most climate organizations to the public in the global north is that they can retain their current lifestyles and just switch out the energy source. Just switch out fossil fuels for renewables and you will be able to carry on your current lifestyle. And even if that were possible, that will just like switch the forms of extraction. Instead of extracting fossil fuels from the global south and having them suffer the consequences of that, you'll be extracting other kinds of resources. I mean, there is already child labor in Congo in cobalt mines. I mean, Elon Musk is already like threatening to have a coup in Bolivia if he needs lithium from it. So this is like where we kind of really differ from mainstream organizations, that we do not sell that you can continue to have the lifestyle that you have today. We need like significant changes, and we do not claim that we have all the answers. That we tell you do this, that, one, two, and three, and, you know, the world will be perfect. So one of our major demands is what we call citizens' assemblies. So citizens' assemblies, they are like a new form of democratic practice. It's kind of what you might call a jury system for policy, where you randomly select a representative group of people from whatever area you're carrying out the citizens' assembly in, give them all the expert advice, all the science, policy expertise that's needed, and they come up with a solution for a problem. So this has been done very successfully in Ireland to settle on contentious issues like abortion. These difficult issues, I mean, politicians who want to be like reelected, they don't often want to touch. They don't want to take positions on these. So this is a very good mechanism to get around our current deadlock situations in democracy and to get the public involved in democratic practice. So one of our demands is a citizens' assembly for climate, so that presented with the science, the public comes up with the appropriate solutions. We are just like in October, we were out on the streets pointing out how much billionaires are responsible for the climate damage being done, the huge investments that fund managers like BlackRock are continuing to do in fossil fuels. I mean, a totally mainstream organization like the International Energy Agency, founded by Henry Kissinger, for God's sake, has said that there should be no new fossil fuels. And yet companies like BlackRock continue to invest in those. We were at BlackRock, and we're protesting at BlackRock and blockading their offices and at many other institutions for a week in October. So that's basically what we are doing, being out on the streets and holding these organizations, these companies and these corporations accountable for the damage that they continue to do.
I also want to, Basav Sen, ask you about your thoughts on the wealthy countries that are still trying to push offsets through negotiations on Article 6 of the Paris Agreement. And while you may not be blockading the offices, although I dare say you have no problem with that of BlackRock, your thoughts on really what intellectually and programmatically needs to be pushed in the time that we have left?
So offsets are a sham. They are a way for polluting corporations to buy their way out of cutting their pollution. So, for instance, instead of eliminating an oil refinery, because really there is no future for oil. Oil refineries need to be phased out. The refinery operator says, oh, no worries, I'll keep pumping out greenhouse gases here, but I will make sure that that forest over there keeps sucking out an equivalent amount of CO2 from the sky. Now, there's huge problems with this argument. Number one, next to the refinery, there's a community, usually a poor community, usually black or brown or indigenous, and that community will keep breathing the other toxic pollutants, the nitrogen oxides and volatile organic compounds that the refinery emits. So they are still subject to cancer and other forms of illnesses. And meanwhile, where that so-called forest exists, there often is a traditional farming community or a group of indigenous people who then get displaced to make room for this corporation's offset. So there's injustice at both ends. And then, notoriously, forests that are selected for carbon offsets, different corporations select that same forest for an offset. So there's double counting of the amount of emissions the forest actually removes. And then forests that have been sold as offsets have still been illegally logged and cut down, or they've burned down in wildfires. So offsets do not work. But now the U.S. is pushing a proposal to expand offsets on a massive scale by saying that corporations can now buy offsets based on future direct air capture technology, which is a machine to literally suck carbon dioxide out of the sky. Some of us call them unicorns because these machines don't really exist. I'm being a little facetious. There are some, you know, experimental versions of them that exist, but they cost a massive amount of money. They use a massive amount of energy. They're just not practical. And we cannot rely on something like that to somehow suck emissions out of the sky.
Well, then let me just say this, given the limited time. So we have our agenda. The issue is absolutely and unequivocally to deal with the issue of the carbon emissions and to stop the polluters. And for that, I turn to groups like Extinction Rebellion. So we're going to give you the last word just for this program. We're going to have you both back. But the last word on what is to be done, given our time frame. Sayak?
We need a mass mobilization of people to basically force corporations and the government to just stop fossil fuel emissions. I mean, we know what needs to be done. Stop creating new fossil fuel projects. Citibank can do that. Chase can do that. BlackRock can do that. But they will not do that unless we force them and force the government to do it. I mean, and make no mistake, there's not really a separation between these corporations, between these banks and the government. When we blockaded Citibank, they came and told us, hey, what can we do? The government sets policy. Come on. Whoever is Citibank CEO one day is Treasury Secretary the next day. There's a complete revolving door between these two entities. So we need mass mobilization to be out on the streets to force them to stop investing in fossil fuels.
So we have to understand that COP27 is a cop-out. Once again, it rests with we the people. And Greta Thunberg said, hey, we need billions in the streets to make these things happen. Just in the seconds that we have left, Shayak, how can people get in touch with your organization? And Basav Sen, how can people similarly get the wonderful studies and writing that you've done as the director of the Climate Policy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies? Shayak, how do people touch base? And Basav Sen.
This is a great week for people to get in touch with Extinction Rebellion. This is a new Rebel Welcome Week. just search on the internet for Extinction Rebellion NYC. You will find our website, our events page. All week we are holding kind of an open house for people to come into Extinction Rebellion and get engaged. And I know you have a lot of viewers in D.C. So Extinction Rebellion Washington, D.C., on Saturday afternoon, they are holding a nonviolent direct action training followed by an actual nonviolent direct action targeted against the local utility that wants to keep promoting gas. So I believe that it's at noon. Go to their website. You can do one or both, the training and the action. And that's another wonderful way for people to really get engaged and out on the streets and making a difference.
And a website for the Climate Policy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies?
Yes. Our website is www.ips-dc.org. And if you go to our website, you will find a page for all of our different projects. You will find a page for all of our staff experts, and so you'll find a page for me as well, and you'll find a lot of our writings and reports and so on.
We thank you for listening. We educate, agitate, and organize. For Building Bridges, I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
I'm Ken Nash.
And thank you for listening.